Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide here in Tandanya on the lands of Gunamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show...
Social media provides a platform for young people with disability to find others who share similar interests. We know that rates of loneliness are increasing, particularly amongst young people.
As the implementation of the under 16 social media ban looms, advocates fear the ban could see an end to vital lines of connection and community for children with disability, with many calling for support in the transition. Also, a collaborative South Australian art exhibition is providing a platform for connection and expression around mental health awareness. And later...
The findings in the report that I think are really relevant is the ways in which police are often colluding with perpetrators of family violence and allowing themselves to be weaponised by perpetrators in forms of systems abuse against victim survivors.
Recent research reveals reports from Victorian frontline workers who say harmful policing of domestic violence is widespread, prompting urgent calls for a new approach, including community-based pathways for victim survivors. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, in the Hunter Valley, the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, announced yesterday the Narrabri gas project is vital for the area, warning the government would consider compulsory land acquisitions if a deal were not reached between farmers and gas giant Santos. Premier Minns' response stems from Tomago Aluminium's warning it will most likely have to close down because they have been unable to secure an affordable price for electricity. But around 60% of farmers and landowners in the proposed gas line corridor have so far refused to sign a deal with Santos because they claim it poses a risk to natural water resources. 2NUR's news director Ian Crouch started by asking President of the Hunter Gas Landholder Rights Alliance, Mick Fetch, his initial reactions to Premier Minns' statement.
My initial reaction is that it's obvious that a desperate company, Santos being the proponent of this pipeline, leaning on the Premier to lean on landholders. And landholders have been leant on since 2008, 2009 regarding this project, and they still haven't got a pipeline route. So how can they be compulsorily acquiring land when they haven't got a pipeline route? They've got a 200-metre survey corridor.
Obviously, that's causing some concern for farmers. I mean, particularly, we're hearing from the Farmers Federation, they're worried about the impact on local water resources as well. I guess that's one of the major issues.
It's a major issue. Santos have made it quite clear that they'd like to bring their operations down in through the Liverpool Plains, and that's the nation's food bowl. And let's be clear, the operation involves drilling down in through the Great Artesian Basin. So it's a major risk for our water supplies. But not only that, we have a different set of issues down here in the Hunter. You take my property, for example. The pipeline runs 60, 70 metres from my house, and now we're being told by some of the country's leading insurance companies that we won't be able to insure our property for public liability, farm insurance, house and contents, if we host gas infrastructure. That's just one of the major problems for us, which is, as I said, that's common up and down the route, but there are some different issues down this end as well.
How does it make you feel when you've got the Premier trying to force the issue on landholders such as yourself?
Well, it makes us angry. It just makes us angrier and more determined to say no to this project. The Premier's forgetting that there's a process that needs to be followed, and the proponent Santos need to prove to the minister that that land that they're wanting to acquire is available for compulsory acquisition. So they have to put in an application to get the government to vest that easement in to Santos. So it's not just a matter of the Premier coming on, standing up in front of a union meeting and saying, this is what we need to happen. It's the law of the land that this process is followed. So landholders, as I said, have been doing this for a long time now. We're well informed, and there's 60% of us along the route have refused to speak to Santos about this pipeline. So if they think that it's just going to happen easily, it's not.
So the fight continues by the sounds of things.
The fight continues. I've said it before that certainly on my property, anything that happens here regarding this pipeline will be against my will. I will never, ever sign a document to say that they can put this pipeline here. It's not really about money, even though the compensation rates are absolutely laughable when you compare it to something like a coal mine or renewable projects. What they're offering is laughable, and it'll never happen on this place.
Mick Fetch from the Hunter Gas Landholder Rights Alliance speaking with 2NUR's Ian Crouch.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire. Daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
With under 16 social media ban beginning on the 10th of December, concerns for the well-being of children living with a disability and rural Australians are rising as they lose contact from online communities. But the government believes the ban is necessary to protect the mental health of young Australians, as the risk of harm offsets the positives of having an account. Social media apps like TikTok and Snapchat will be responsible for making sure under 16s are not on their platforms, risking fines of up to $50 million if they don't take reasonable steps to prevent this group from having accounts. Ella Panizzolo spoke with CEO of Children and Young People with Disability Australia, Skye Kokoschke-Moore, to find out about what this change means for young Australians and those living with a disability.
Social media provides a platform for young people with disability to find others that share their interests, to explore communities that are beyond their front door. It really can be a lifeline for young people who experience quite a lot of discrimination and exclusion from their everyday environments.
What are the biggest concerns of removing access to this form of communication?
Social media provides a platform for young people with disability to find others who share similar interests. We know that rates of loneliness are increasing, particularly amongst young people, and by removing social media as a way in which young people are able to find others to help them build a sense of identity and to understand the world around them and talk to others that have been through similar things to them, it's really going to have a huge impact on those young people.
How could this ban further impact the well-documented exclusion already faced by children with disability?
We know from a survey that Children and Young People with Disability Australia ran earlier this year that 75% of students who responded said that they'd experienced bullying in the last 12 months, and 72% had said that they'd experienced exclusion from school. When we have students who are being excluded from the physical environments they're entitled to attend, by removing social media, we really are withholding an opportunity for them to find that social connection that's so important for development.
The government says the policy is necessary to protect the mental health and well-being of Australian teens, but could it be doing more harm than good? What is your response to the mental health concerns, especially those advocating for what they believe is a detox or removal of overstimulation from continued social media distractions?
There's no doubt that social media can be a dangerous place, but we need to be really careful that we're not trying to solve a wicked problem with a very simplistic solution. Social media is vital for young people with disability because of the discrimination and exclusion they experience in the world. And so we really encourage the government to monitor closely the impact that this ban is going to have on young people.
What would you like to see policymakers do to help support young Australians and people living with a disability during this transition period of social media bans?
The government and social media platforms need to make it really clear what options are still available for young people to connect online. We know that the world has changed really quickly and that the environments that many of us grew up in and are used to navigating still exist, but they're vastly different. And so it's really important that the governments and social media really listen to the impact that this ban is having on young people and adapt the course of action if necessary. We don't want a situation where we have a whole new generation of young people who are growing up in an environment where they're unable to make friends, unable to find places where they're able to explore their interests, and unable to have a really good platform in which they're able to express themselves.
Are there any compromises you would like to see considered before the social media ban occurs?
The government's made it really clear that this ban is going ahead. Social media platforms need to do a lot of hard work to make sure that the platforms and opportunities that they're providing for the public are safe. There's only so much governments can do, and there's only so much young people can do navigating a system that they don't have any control over. So it's really important that governments and social media platforms listen to what young people with disability need.
Do you have any suggestions in terms of how the government can work with social media companies during this phase out, especially in terms of testing guidelines with diverse communities?
It's vital that any guidelines that are developed are tested with young people with disabilities so that they're able to share exactly what these guidelines will mean for them. We so often see new policies or laws rolled out in Australia that haven't been subject to thorough community consultation, let alone consultation with young people. It's really important that the government takes a long-term view about the impact that the laws it's passing is going to have on Australia's future generations.
CEO of Children and Young People with Disability Australia, Skye Kokoschke-Moore, speaking with The Wire's Ella Panizzolo. Recent statistics show 1 in 4 women and 1 in 14 men have experienced intimate partner violence since the age of 15, a stark reminder of a worsening crisis. Australia's response to domestic violence is evolving, including South Australia's latest Royal Commission, the spread of coercive control laws, through to increased training for police and law enforcement. But recent research reveals policing practices of domestic violence are often causing more harm than help. Harm in the name of safety, a report by the Beyond Survival Project, FlatOut and RMIT University, highlights condemning evidence from Victorian frontline workers who say harmful policing of domestic violence is widespread, prompting urgent calls for community-based pathways for victim survivors. The Wire's Tia Bailey spoke with co-author and senior lecturer in Criminology and Justice Studies, Dr. Peter Mallins.
So our report, which surveyed 225 family violence workers from across Victoria, found that there were lots of ways in which police responses to family violence were actually harming victim survivors rather than helping them. And three of the key ways that this was happening was that police are often misidentifying victim survivors as perpetrators of family violence. The findings in the report that I think are really relevant is the ways in which police are often colluding with perpetrators of family violence and allowing themselves to be weaponized by perpetrators in forms of systems abuse against victim survivors. What we found is that in many cases, police are actually operating as an extension of family violence. And then the final of the three key issues that we found was the fact that police perpetrated family violence where police officers are themselves is vast and widespread across the state. And what we found in the report is a pervasiveness of the willingness of police to protect police who are perpetrating family violence.
The research includes over 200 perspectives of Victorian frontline workers who documented their experiences of police responses to family violence. In a statement, a spokesperson from Victoria Police told The Wire, "We work closely with our sector-wide partners and regularly engage with family violence support groups and professionals to hear their insights and strengthen our response. The safety of victims is at the forefront of everything we do. All police receive extensive family violence training, which includes how to accurately identify predominant aggressors." Despite the report only focusing in Victoria, Dr. Mallon suggests the issue is impacting Australia-wide.
We don't feel like this is a problem that is confined at all to Victoria. And I think the ways in which the evidence that we looked at points to the underlying deeper structural and foundational problems with policing. You know, policing in this country, in the settler colony, is founded on colonial violence and also has a long history of sexism and misogyny and racism in the police forces across the country. This report argues and recommends that we do decenter policing and invest much more heavily in alternative responses, including alternative first responses and crisis responses to family violence, as well as broader community-based prevention and response work.
SA has recently passed its Royal Commission into Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence. It has also recently passed coercive control laws, with similar laws have been implemented in New South Wales and Queensland. With this in mind, what does the report highlight in terms of solutions around improved police responses to coercive control? And what lessons can be shared more broadly with other states?
I think in many ways it is a shame that so many states have moved to criminalise coercive control, because on the one hand, while it is really, really important that as a society we identify and acknowledge the nature of coercive control and how pervasive it is, if the sorts of things that are identified in our research around misidentification, collusion and systems abuse are in fact widespread and continuing, which our report suggests they are, those things will only be enhanced or increased rather through the added criminalisation of coercive control.
As criminalisation of coercive control and plans to address domestic violence increase, several advocacy organisations have welcomed additional specialised training for law enforcement. But according to the report, these issues need a different approach.
So things like obviously housing and health and mental health and parenting supports and early childhood development that actually lead to primary prevention of violence and coercive control, secondary prevention around increasing welfare payments and access to crisis accommodations, education and truth telling so we understand the extent of these issues, also investing in new alternative first responder initiatives where it can be community and survivor-led teams that are trained in crisis response and trained in de-escalation, and also alternative accountability processes. So transformative justice-based, survivor-centered, meaningful forms of accountability that the criminal so-called justice system can't actually often offer, and behaviour change work that can go alongside that as well. As I was suggesting earlier, a lot of research and ours as well suggests that reforms like training are not going to be sufficient to actually address the deeply embedded foundational and structural and cultural problems with policing as an institution. And yeah, what we really need is a much more nuanced approach to these things, and to, I think, as a society, stop thinking that criminalising things is the only way or the best way to solve or respond to issues like this.
Co-author and senior lecturer in criminology and justice studies, Dr. Peter Mallins, speaking with The Wire's Tia Bailey. If you or someone you know is struggling with domestic, family or sexual violence, help is available. Phone 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. Or call 13 YARN on 139276.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Artists with lived experience of mental health challenges are taking centre stage at the Mindshare exhibition located at the North Adelaide Library for Mental Health Awareness Month. The annual event, which runs until tomorrow, is a collaboration between community organisations showcasing visual art, writing and photography, which aims to spark open conversation regarding mental health while celebrating creativity as a form of expression and healing. Ella Panizzolo spoke with Lucy Wade, Life Without Barriers South Australian Director of Child, Youth and Family Services, and Verity Jantz, a kinship carer whose nephew is involved in the art exhibition.
Life Without Barriers is a supporting agency for myself and my nephew as part of their Child, Youth, Family program. My nephew participates in the Living Arts program with Life Without Barriers and headed up by Fee Theodoros.
So Life Without Barriers has been collaborating on the Mindshare Group exhibition for a while now. So we host it every year in October, and it's a partnership between ourselves, the Mental Health Coalition of South Australia, NEOMIS National Arts Program, in addition to Skylight Mental Health and the City of Adelaide.
Can you share from your understanding what role does art play when it comes to mental health and wellbeing?
There's two factors here, well, actually three: preventative, educational, also providing an outlet for people who find it difficult to actually communicate their experience in traditional formats such as talking or even actually letting people know what it is that they need.
So I might just preface by saying that Life Without Barriers is obviously a national organisation. We support clients who are experiencing mental health struggles. Our connection and Verity's connection to the exhibition is really through our Living Arts programme, and the Living Arts programme forms part of our Foster and Kinship Care programme. So it's an arts-based programme for children with a care experience, and it really is an opportunity for them to showcase their voice and engage in therapeutic arts-based activities. And it's well evidenced that there is a link and a connection between the creative arts and positive mental health, particularly around recovery and therapeutic intervention. And I think whilst the process of creation itself is incredibly therapeutic, the process of creation also involves bringing people together. So that's very much our approach when we are coordinating arts-based activities. We do some individual work, but wherever possible, we bring people together.
What responses have some of the artists that have been involved in the exhibition had to say?
Jasper talks about when he was younger, he would find it really difficult to express himself. However, art has always been, when I say art, I'm talking from music, drawing, but there would be times when he would have really struggled to relate his experience, you know, whatever that was at that time. And so he would draw pictures, and then they became, I guess, a guide for me to then help to explore and be able to support him better. That ultimately was his form of communication. He's much older now, he's 13 now, and he has a lot of language, and that language is born out of the creative way he used to express himself from the beginning. And what that means for him now is he has this incredible language around his emotions, his experiences, and being a part of things like the Mindshare exhibition, what he says is that this actually gives him a voice. So he feels seen. You know, children, particularly children in the out-of-home care sector, are amongst our most vulnerable population. And I think there's a lot of shame and stigma attached. And to be able to have a space where he feels seen and witnessed in his experience as a human being is invaluable.
How important do you believe collective exhibitions like this are when it comes to sharing individual stories of well-being and mental health awareness, as well as public perception?
It's a really powerful and tangible way, actually, of kind of showcasing the strength and resilience that exists in, you know, when people are struggling with mental health. I think that all too often when we talk about mental health, it's done in a very negative light, and we talk about mental health struggles and poor mental health. But actually, the beauty of recovery and the beauty of positive mental health is around connection and around the strategies that people use to be able to support positive mental health. Often the artwork that people create is something that they do and that's quite hidden. So I think having the opportunity to exhibit and to show and share the work that they've created is incredibly validating for them, for the pieces that they've created, but also for them as individuals.
What have been some of the changes over the years?
One of the things that we've tried to do over time is to really evolve the exhibition. And over time, I guess we learn and evolve about how we can maximise the value and impact of the exhibition. And one of the things that we've done more recently is really think about how can we live and breathe and demonstrate our values as an organisation in walking alongside young people, making sure that we walk the talk. And one of the things that we have done more recently in this exhibition is to facilitate a piece that's been developed by team members, so Life Without Barriers staff, that really looks at the values that we try and emulate every day as an organisation and as individuals within that organisation.
It's not just Life Without Barriers, there's Skylight Mental Health. I think, you know, the power is when it's not just one organisation showcasing or stepping into that space, it's how they all link together to then benefit all of their clients. And I just think that's a really something special.
In terms of moving forward, how would you like to see policymakers prioritise art in relation to mental health?
You know, it wasn't so long ago that NDIS actually removed art therapies from funded therapies. They've brought that back in since. The value it has on somebody's internal view of themselves is really important as well.
Lucy Wade, Life Without Barriers South Australian Director of Child, Youth and Family Services, and Verity Jantz, a kinship carer, speaking with The Wire's Ella Panizzolo. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandanya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show brought to you from 4EB in Brisbane. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SEI in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire. Thank you.